eternal world. It is tempting, therefore, to regard such beings as imaginative constructions, as personifications of subjective affective or emotional states or drives, the incarnated form of subjective experience. The term personification, however, implies a voluntary act, connotes the conscious use of metaphor on the part of the individual driven to represent and knowing that he is representing. There is no indication, however, that it is an act of conscious creation that gives rise to the pre-experimental deity. In fact, the opposite appears more true. It is the action of the deity that gives rise to creative endeavor as such on the part of the creating subject. The god must therefore be more than the subject, more than the subject's original narrative conception of himself. The phenomena that we would now describe as emotions or motive forces from the perspective of our modern, comparatively differentiated and acute self-consciousness do not appear to have been experienced precisely as internal in their original form. Rather, they made their appearance as part and parcel of the experience, the event or sequence of events that gave rise to them, and adopted initial representational form in imaginative embodiment. The modern idea of the stimulus might be regarded as a vestigial remnant of this form of thinking, a form that grants the power of affective and behavioral control to the object, or which cannot distinguish between that which elicits a response and the response itself. We no longer think animistically as adults, except in our weaker or more playful moments, because we attribute motivation and emotion to our own agency and not, generally, to the stimulus that gives proximal rise to them. We can separate the thing from the implication of the thing, because we are students and beneficiaries of empirical thinking and experimental method. We can remove attribution of motive and affective power from the object and leave it standing in its purely sensory and consensual aspect, can distinguish between what is us and what is world. The pre-experimental mind could not, cannot do this, at least not consistently, could not reliably discriminate between the object and its effect on behavior. It is that object and effect which in totality constitute a god. More accurately, it is a class of objects and their effects that constitute a god. A god, so considered, more specifically a potent and powerful god, one with a history, constitutes the manner in which a group or family of stimuli of isomorphic motivational significance reveals itself to or grips the collective, communicated imagination of a given culture. Such a representation is a peculiar mix from the later empirical viewpoint of psychological and sociological phenomena and objective fact, an undifferentiated mix of subject and object, of emotion and sensory experience, transpersonal in nature, as it is historically elaborated construction and shared imaginative experience. The primitive deity nonetheless serves as accurate representation of the ground of being, however, because it is affect and subjectivity as well as pure object before the two are properly distilled or separated, because it is primordial experience rather than the mere primordial thing. The original children of Tiamat and Apsu, the elder gods, should therefore be regarded as embodiments of the archaic, transpersonal, intrapsychic phenomena that gave rise to human motivation, as well as those aspects of the objective world that activate those intrapsychic systems. The Sumerians considered themselves destined to clothe and feed such gods, because they viewed themselves as the servants, in a sense, of what we would call instinctive forces elicited by the environment. Such forces can be reasonably regarded as the Sumerians regarded them, as deities inhabiting a supra-celestial place, extant prior to the dawn of humanity. Erotic attraction, for example, a powerful god, has a developmental history that predates the emergence of humanity, is associated with relatively innate releasing stimuli, those that characterize erotic beauty, is of terrible power, and has an existence transcending that of any individual who is currently possessed. Pan, the Greek god of nature, produced or represented fear, produced panic. Ares, or the Roman Mars, warlike fury and aggression. We no longer personify such instincts, except for the purposes of literary embellishment, so we don't think of them existing in a place, like heaven, for example. But the idea that such instincts inhabit a space, and that wars occur in that space, is a metaphor of exceeding power and explanatory utility. Transpersonal motive forces do wage war with one another over vast spans of time, are each forced to come to terms with their powerful opponents in the intrapsychic hierarchy. The battles between the different ways of life or different philosophies that eternally characterize human societies can usefully be visualized as combat undertaken by different standards of value and, therefore, by different hierarchies of motivation. The forces involved in such wars do not die, as they are immortal. The human beings acting as pawns of the gods during such times are not so fortunate. Back to the Enuma Elish. The secondary patriarchal deities of the Mesopotamian celestial pantheon, including the couples Lamu and Lahamu and Kishar and Anshar, arose as a direct consequence of the interactions of the original sexualized unity of Tiamat and Apsu, the most primal of couples. This undifferentiated pre-cosmogonic egg, a common metaphor in other creation myths, contains an alloy of order, the masculine principle, and chaos, the feminine principle. This alloy is the world parents locked in creative embrace. Is spirit and matter, conceived alternatively, still one thing? Tiamat and Apsu's union give rise to children, the primordial instincts or forces of life who, in turn, engender more individualized beings. The Enuma Elish itself does not spend much time fleshing out the specific characteristics of these forces of life as it is concerned with more general issues. Lamu and Lahamu and Kishar and Anshar are incidental characters, serving only as intermediaries between the real protagonists of the drama, Marduk, a late-born, individual-like god, and Tiamat, his turncoat mother. Kishar and Anshar therefore serve only as progenitors of Anu, who in turn begot E, his likeness, the master of his fathers, broad of understanding, wise, mighty in strength, much stronger than his grandfather Anshar, without rival among the gods, his brothers. The elder gods serve merely to reproduce and to noisily act. Their incessant racket and movement upsets the divine parents, disturbs the inner parts of Tiamat. So Tiamat and Apsu conspire to devour their children. This is a common mythological occurrence, one echoed later in the story of Yahweh, Noah, and the flood. The gods give birth to the cosmos, but ceaselessly attempt to destroy it. E catches wind of his parents' plot, however, and slays Apsu, adding insult to injury by building a house on his remains, and by naming that house Apsu in mockery or remembrance. Into this house he brings his bride, Damkina, who soon gives birth to Marduk, the hero of the story, the wisest of the wise, the wisest of the gods, filled with awe-inspiring majesty. When E saw his son, according to the text, he rejoiced, he beamed, his heart was filled with joy. He distinguished him and conferred upon him double equality with the gods, so that he was highly exalted and surpassed them in everything. Artfully arranged beyond comprehension were his members, not fit for human understanding, hard to look upon. Four were his eyes, four were his ears. When his lips moved, fire blazed forth. Each of his four ears grew large, and likewise his eyes, to see everything. He was exalted among the gods, surpassing was his form. His members were gigantic, he was surpassing in height. Meriutu, Meriutu, son of the sun god of the gods. Marduk is characterized by the metaphoric associates of consciousness. He has exaggerated sensory capacities. His very words are characterized by creative and destructive power, by the transformative capacity of fire. He is the sun god above all, which means that he is assimilated to, or, more accurately, occupies the same categorical space as sight, vision, illumination, enlightenment, dawn, the elimination of darkness, and the death of the night. In the midst of all this action, war plans, death, birth, Anu, Marduk's grandfather, E's father, busies himself with the generation of the four winds. His work raises waves upon the surface of the waters occupied by Tiamat and the previously unidentified primary matriarchal sub-deities that apparently accompany her there. This new intrusion troubles her beyond tolerance. Upset as she was already at the noise of her offspring and death of her husband, she decides to rid the universe of the secondary patriarchal elder gods once and for all, and begins to produce horrible soldiers to aid her in battle. Bearing monster serpents, sharp of tooth and not sparing the fang, with poison instead of blood she filled their bodies. Ferocious dragons she clothed with terror. She crowned them with fear-inspiring glory and made them like gods, so that he who would look upon them should perish from terror. The angry Tiamat, the unknown, chaos, in its terrible or destructive aspect, produces 11 species of monsters to aid her in her battle, including the viper, the dragon, the great lion, the rabid dog, the scorpion man, and the storm demon. She elects the firstborn, Kingu by name, to reign over them all, giving him the Tablet of Destinies to signify his ascension and dominion. The story continues. After Tiamat had made strong preparations, she made ready to join battle with the gods, her offspring. To avenge Apsu, Tiamat did this evil. How she got ready for the attack was revealed to E. When E heard of this matter, he became benumbed with fear and sat in silent gloom. After he had reflected on the matter and his wrath had subsided, he went to Anshar, his great-grandfather. And when he had come into the presence of Anshar, his great-grandfather, he communicated to him all that Tiamat had planned. Now, although Apsu isn't well described in the Enuma Elish, it is clear that he is the masculine consort of Tiamat. The masculine consort of the goddess of the unknown is inevitably the god of the known, or his progenitor and dependent, the knower. It is the known that serves as protection from the unknown, whether this is understood or not. E kills Apsu, which means that he unconsciously strips himself of protection. E might therefore be reasonably regarded as representative of that part of humanity eternally and ignorantly contemptuous of tradition and willing to undermine or destroy the past without understanding its necessity or nature. Those unconsciously protected from the outside world by the walls of culture may become irritated by the limitations such walls represent and incautiously pull them down. This act of destruction, disguised as a blow for freedom, lets the terrible unknown flood back in. The Great Mother is a terrible force in the absence of patriarchal protection. The Enuma Elish makes this vital point implicitly. This state of affairs is represented schematically in Figure 20, the death of Apsu and the reemergence of Tiamat as threat. Anshar is terribly upset by the news of Tiamat's anger. He asks E to stand against Tiamat. E fails, deservedly, and Anshar sends Anu in his stead. He is routed as well and returns, overcome by terror. In desperation and final hope, Anshar and E call on Marduk, the young sun god. The story continues. E called Marduk to his private room. He advised him, telling him the plan of his heart. "Marduk, consider my idea. Hearken to thy father. Thou art he, my son, who relieves his heart. Draw nigh into the presence of Anshar, ready for battle. Speak and stand forth. When he sees thee, he will be at rest." Marduk was glad at the word of his father. He drew nigh and stood before Anshar. When Anshar saw him, his heart was filled with joy. He kissed his lips. His fear was removed. "Anshar, be not silent, but open thy lips. I will go and accomplish all that is in thy heart. What man is it who has brought battle against thee?" "Tiamat, who is a woman, is coming against thee with arms." "My father, creator, be glad and rejoice. Soon thou shalt trample upon the neck of Tiamat." "Yea, my father, creator, be glad and rejoice. Soon thou shalt trample upon the neck of Tiamat." Anshar answers, "My son, who knowest all wisdom, quiet Tiamat with thy holy incantation." Marduk's magic words, remember, he speaks fire, are clearly and reasonably portrayed as one of the most powerful weapons in the battle against the forces of chaos. Anshar continues, "On the storm chariot, quickly pursue the way, turn her back." The Lord was glad at the word of his father. His heart exulted, and he said to his father, "Lord of the gods, destiny of the great gods, if I am indeed to be your avenger, to vanquish Tiamat and to keep you alive, convene the assembly and proclaim my lot supreme. When ye are joyfully seated together in the court of assembly, may I, through the utterance of my mouth, determine the destinies instead of you. Whatever I create shall remain unaltered. The command of my lips shall not return. It shall not be changed." Alexander Heidel, who provided the translation of the Enuma Elish cited here, comments, "Marduk demands supreme and undisputed authority as the price for risking his life in combat with Tiamat. When, therefore, the gods at the New Year's festival convened in the court of assembly, they reverently waited on Marduk, the king of the gods of heaven and earth, and in that spirit they decided the destinies. The gods, indeed, continue to determine destinies long after Marduk has received the powers he here desires. But the final decision rested with Marduk, so that in the last analysis, it was he who decided the fates." This is an example of the hierarchical organization of the gods, a concept frequently encapsulated in mythology, and one we shall return to later. All the original children of Tiamat are potent and impersonal elder gods, psychological forces, the deities that eternally rule or constitute human motivation and affect. The question of the proper ordering of those forces, who or what should rule, is the central problem of morality and the primary problem facing human individuals and social organizations. The Sumerian solution to this problem was the elevation of Marduk, the sun god who voluntarily faces chaos, to the position of king, and the subjugation of the other gods to that king. Anshar opened his mouth and addressed these words to Kaka, his vizier. "Kaka, my vizier, who gladdenest my heart, unto Lamu and Lahamu I will send thee. Thou knowest how to discern and art able to relate. Cause the gods, my fathers, to be brought before me. Let them bring all the gods to me. Let them converse and sit down to banquet. Let them eat bread and prepare wine. For Marduk, their avenger, let them decree the destiny. Set out, O Kaka, go, and stand thou before them. What I am about to tell thee, repeat unto them. Anshar, your son, has sent me. The command of his heart he has charged me to convey, saying, Tiamat, our bearer, hates us. She held a meeting and raged furiously. All the gods went over to her. Even those who you have created march at her side. They separated themselves and went over to the side of Tiamat. They were angry. They plotted, not resting day or night. They took up the fight, fuming and raging. They held a meeting and planned the conflict. Mother Huber, Tiamat, who fashions all things, added thereto irresistible weapons, bearing monster serpents sharp of tooth and not sparing the fang. With poison instead of blood, she filled their bodies. Ferocious dragons she clothed with terror. She crowned them with fear-inspiring glory and made them like gods, so that they might cause him who would look upon them to perish from terror, so that their bodies might leap forward and none turn back their breasts. She set up the viper, the dragon, and the lahumum, the great lion, the mad dog, and the scorpion man, driving storm demons, the dragonfly, and the bison, bearing unsparing weapons, unafraid of battle. Powerful are her decrees, irresistible are they. Altogether, 11 kinds of monsters of this sort she brought into being. Of those among the gods, her firstborn who formed her assembly, she exalted Kingu. In their midst she made him great, to march at the head of the army, to direct the forces, to raise the weapons for the engagement, to launch the attack, the high command of the battle. She entrusted to his hand. She caused him to sit in the assembly, saying, I have cast the spell for thee. I have made thee great in the assembly of the gods. The dominion over all the gods I have given into thy hand. Mayest thou be highly exalted, thou, my unique spouse. May thy names become greater than those of the Anunnaki. She gave him the tablet of destinies. She fastened it upon his breast, saying, As for thee, thy command shall not be changed. The word of thy mouth shall be dependable. Now, when Kingu had been exalted and had received supreme dominion, they decreed the destinies of the gods, her sons, saying, May the opening of our mouths quiet the fire god. May thy overpowering poison vanquish the opposing night. I sent Anu, but he could not face her. E also was afraid and turned back. Then Marduk, the wisest of the gods, your son, came forward. His heart prompted him to face Tiamat. He opened his mouth and said to me, If I am indeed to be your avenger, to vanquish Tiamat and to keep you alive, convene the assembly and proclaim my lot supreme. When ye are joyfully seated together in the court of assembly, may I, through the utterance of my mouth, determine the destinies instead of you. Whatever I create shall remain unaltered. The command of my lips shall not return void. It shall not be changed. Hasten to me then, and speedily fix for him your destiny, that he may go to meet your powerful enemy. The hierarchical organization of the gods is represented schematically in Figure 21, World of Gods, Hierarchical Organization, which portrays Marduk as the superordinate personality or pattern of action designed to transform the unbearable present into the desired future. The Enuma Elish states, essentially, When things are normal, any god might rule. However, in the case of a true crisis, everyone turns to the sun god, the embodiment of consciousness. Perhaps it is reasonable to presume, therefore, that he should always reign supreme. The formulation of this hypothesis was a work of unsurpassed genius and a decisive move in the history of the Western mind. The vizier Kaka goes on his way, as commanded, and spreads the word among the secondary patriarchal elder deities who assemble to contemplate the upcoming battle. They entered into the presence of Anshar and filled the court of assembly. They kissed one another as they came together in the assembly. They conversed and sat down to a banquet. They ate bread and prepared wine. The sweet wine dispelled their fears. Their bodies swelled as they drank the strong drink. Exceedingly carefree were they. Their spirit was exalted. For Marduk, their avenger, they decreed the destiny. They erected for him a lordly throne dais and he took his place before his fathers to receive sovereignty. Thou art the most important among the great gods. Thy destiny is unequaled. Thy command is like that of Anu. Marduk, thou art the most important among the great gods. Thy destiny is unequaled. Thy command is like that of Anu. From this day onward, thy command shall not be changed. To exalt and abase, this shall be thy power. Dependable shall be the utterance of thy mouth. Thy command shall not prove vain. None among the gods shall infringe upon thy prerogative. The gods placed the starry garment of the night sky in their midst. At the command of Marduk's mouth, on his word it appears, at his command it disappears, as the night sky on the passage of the sun. Marduk is clearly part of the pantheon who eternally vanquish the dragon of the night. The story continues. When the gods, his fathers, beheld the power of his word, they were glad and did homage, saying, Marduk is king. They bestowed upon him the scepter, the throne, and the royal robe. They gave him an irresistible weapon, smiting the enemy, saying, Go and cut off the life of Tiamat. May the winds carry her blood to out-of-the-way places. After the gods, his fathers, had determined the destiny of Marduk, they set him on the road, the way to success and attainment. Marduk gathers his armaments, bow, club, and lightning, sets himself ablaze, and fashions a net to enclose Tiamat. He is a master of fire and armaments, which is to say, a master of the technology that serves most fundamentally to transform the unknown and terrifying world into the comforting, productive, and familiar. He is able to bind the unknown, to limit its sphere of action, and to bring it under control. He raises the winds and the storm to aid him, using the forces of nature against nature itself. He dresses himself in a terrifying coat of mail and wears terror-inspiring splendor on his head. Prepared carefully in this manner and fortified against poison, he takes the direct route to Tiamat. He confronts re-emergent novelty voluntarily, at a time of his choosing, after careful preparation and without avoidance. His mere appearance strikes terror into the heart of Kingu and his legion of monsters, just as Christ, much later, terrifies the devil and his minions. Marduk confronts Tiamat, accuses her of treachery, and challenges her to battle. When Tiamat heard this, she became like one in a frenzy and lost her reason. Tiamat cried out loud and furiously. To the very roots, her two legs shook back and forth. She recites an incantation, repeatedly casting her spell. As for the gods of battle, they sharpen their weapons. Tiamat and Marduk, the wisest of the gods, advanced against one another. They pressed on to single combat. They approached for battle. Marduk fills Tiamat with an evil wind, which distends her belly. When she opens her mouth to devour him, he lets an arrow fly, which tears her interior and splits her heart. He subdues her completely, casts down her carcass, and stands upon it. His voluntary encounter with the forces of the unknown produces a decisive victory. He rounds up her subordinates, including Kingu, whom he deprives of the Tablet of Destinies, and encapsulates them with netting. Then he returns to Tiamat. The Lord trod upon the hinder part of Tiamat, and with his unsparing club he split her skull. He cut the arteries of her blood and caused the north wind to carry it to out-of-the-way places. He split her open like a muscle into two parts. Half of her he set in place and formed the sky therewith as a roof. He fixed the crossbar and posted guards. He commanded them not to let her waters escape. He crossed the heavens and examined the regions. He placed himself opposite the Apsu, the dwelling of E. The Lord measured the dimensions of the Apsu, and a great structure he established, namely Isherah, earth. Marduk then constructs the heavenly order, fashioning the year, defining the 12-sign zodiac, determining the movement of the stars, the planets, and the moon. Finally, he deigns to create man, out of Kingu, the greatest and most guilty of Tiamat's allies, so that upon him shall the services of the gods be imposed, that they may be at rest. Then he returns the gods allied with him to their appropriate celestial abodes. Grateful, they deliver him a present. Now, O Lord, who hast established our freedom from compulsory service, what shall be the sign of our gratitude before thee? Come, let us make something whose name shall be called sanctuary. It shall be a dwelling for our rest at night. Come, let us repose therein. The dwelling is Babylon, center of civilization, mythic sacred space dedicated in perpetuity to Marduk. The mythic tale of the Enuma Elish describes the nature of the eternal relationship between the unknowable source of all things, the gods who rule human life, and the subject or process who constructs determinate experience through voluntary encounter with the unknown. The full story presented in the Sumerian creation myth is presented schematically in figure 22, the Enuma Elish in schematic representation. Tiamat is portrayed simultaneously as the thing that breeds everything, as the mother of all the gods, as the thing that destroys all things, as the consort of a patriarchal spiritual principle upon whom creation also depends, Apsu, and finally, as the thing that is cut into pieces by the hero who constructs the world. Marduk, the last-born child of instinct, is the hero who voluntarily faces the creative, destructive power that constitutes the place from which all things emerge. He is the martial deity, role model for the culture of the West, who violently carves the unknown into pieces and makes the predictable world from those pieces. This tale contains within it a complex and sophisticated notion of causality. None of its elements exist in contradiction with any other, even though each lays stress on different aspects of the same process. Something must exist prior to the construction of identifiable things, something that cannot be imagined in the absence of a subject. That thing might usefully be portrayed as the all-devouring mother of everything. The particular, discriminable, familiar elements of human experience exist as they do, however, because the conscious subject can detect, construct, and transform them. The sun hero's role in the birth of things is therefore as primal as the mother's, although this part is somewhat more difficult to comprehend. Nonetheless, the Sumerians manage the representation in narrative form. It is a relatively small step from this dramatic imagistic portrayal of the hero to the most explicit Christian doctrine of logos, the creative word, and from there to our notion of consciousness. The mythic tale of Marduk and Tiamat refers to the capacity of the individual to explore voluntarily and to bring things into being as a consequence. The hero cuts the world of the unpredictable, unexplored territory, signified by Tiamat, into its distinguishable elements, weaves a net of determinate meaning capable of encompassing the vast unknown, embodies the divine masculine essence, which has as its most significant feature the capacity to transform chaos into order. The killing of an all-embracing monster and the construction of the universe from its body parts is symbolic, metaphorical representation of the central adaptive process of heroic encounter with the undifferentiated unknown and the construction or generation of differentiated order as a consequence. It is this process, emulated by the emperor of Mesopotamia, who richly embodied Marduk, that served as the basis for his authority, and, indeed, that serves to undergird the idea of lawful authority to the present day. The Mesopotamian emperor's identification with the most divine of all the deities, according to the judgment and election of those self-same powers, lent him power and served to maintain social and psychological order among his people. Furthermore, the Mesopotamian emperor stood in the same relationship to his people as Marduk stood to him, as a ritual model for emulation, as the personality whose actions served as pattern for all actions undertaken in the kingdom, as the personality that was the state, insofar as the state defined and brought order to interpersonal interactions, which, after all, was and is its primary function. Babylon was therefore conceptualized as the kingdom of God on earth, that is, as a profane imitation of heaven. The emperor served this imitated heaven as the imitator of Marduk, at least insofar as he was conservative, just, courageous, and creative. Mircea Eliade comments on the sacrality of the Mesopotamian sovereign and describes the rituals designed to maintain that sacrality. Thus, at Babylon, the Enuma Elish was recited in the temple on the fourth day of the New Year festival. This festival, named Zagmuk, beginning of the year in Sumerian, and Akkitu in Akkadian, note, the Sumerians and Akkadians united to form Babylon, took place during the first 12 days of the month of Nisan. It comprised several sequences, of which we will mention the most important. Number 1. A day of expiation for the king corresponding to Marduk's captivity. Number 2. The freeing of Marduk. Number 3. Ritual combats and a triumphal procession led by the king to the Bit Akkitu, the house of the New Year festival, where a banquet was held. Number 4. The Hieros Gamos, mystical marriage of the king with a Hierodule, ritual slave prostitute personifying the goddess. And number 5. The determination of destinies by the gods. The meaning of some terminology and the nature of the latter two sequences must be clarified here. First, with regard to number 4, it should be noted that Hieros Gamos means mystical marriage, the marriage of the king and the queen or goddess. This marriage provides dramatic representation of the union of the exploratory tendency incarnated by the king with the positive aspect of the unknown incarnated by the Hierodule. Marduk, the king, is originally shut up, signifying his temporary disappearance. See the description of Osiris below. During the normal or routinized operations of the state, he is freed to meet Tiamat. He does so in sexual union. This sexual, read creative union, the juxtaposition of the process of knowing embodied by the king, Marduk, with the unknown embodied by Tiamat, incarnated by the Hierodule, is what gives rise to the generation of new information and patterns of adaptation. The process of generating knowledge is therefore assimilated to the domain of sexual union as the primordial creative process. The deity of chaos, or the unknown, appears most generally as feminine and as half negative and half positive, once the initial division between order and chaos has been established. The attribution of femininity to this deity, so to speak, occurs most fundamentally because the unknown serves as the matrix from which determinate forms are born. The negative attribution, Tiamat serves as example, exists because the unknown has a destructive aspect. The positive, the Hierodule here, Isis in the Egyptian myth of Osiris, Mary in Christianity, because the unknown is also creative or generative. Second, with regard to number 5, it should be noted that the king, in his incarnation as God, served to determine destinies, because he was both hero, ritual model for emulation, and absolute ruler. As such, He literally controlled individual destinies, serving as he did, practically and in representation, as the most powerful individual in society and the most dominant strategy in the hierarchy of behavioral adaptation. What he could not determine by law, however, he was to provide by creative example, since the body of laws, as embodiment of past wisdom, is insufficient to deal with the challenges of the present. This idea is developed much more explicitly by the Egyptians, as we shall see. Back to Iliades' story. The first sequence of this mythico-ritual scenario, the king's humiliation and Marduk's captivity, indicates the regression of the world to the pre-cosmogonic chaos. In the sanctuary of Marduk, the high priest stripped the king of his emblems, scepter, ring, scimitar, and crown, and struck him in the face. Then, on his knees, the king uttered a declaration of innocence. "I have not sinned, O Lord of the lands. I have not been negligent regarding thy divinity." The high priest, speaking in Marduk's name, replied, "Do not fear. Marduk will hear thy prayer. He will increase thy dominion." During this time, the people sought for Marduk, supposed to be shut up in the mountain, a formula indicating the death of a divinity, in consequence of a descent far from the sun and light. When the world regresses to pre-cosmogonic chaos, it is always the case that the hero is missing. The hero is, after all, incarnation of the process by which chaos is transformed into order. If chaos has the upper hand, it is by definition because of a current paucity of heroism. It can be said, therefore, that the reappearance of the Great Mother in her terrible guise, the death of the Great Father, who serves as protection from his creative and destructive wife, and the absence of the hero, who turns chaos into order, all represent different ways of telling the same story, the story which describes a life-threatening imbalance in the powers of the constituent elements of experience. Eliade continues, describing the rediscovery or reemergence of Marduk. "Finally, he was delivered, and the gods assembled, that is, their statues were brought together, to determine the destinies." This episode corresponds in the Enuma Elish to Marduk's advancement to the rank of supreme god. The king led the procession to the Bit Akitu, a building situated outside of the city, outside the domain of civilization or order. The procession represented the army of the gods advancing against Tiamat. According to an inscription of Sennacherib, we may suppose that the primordial battle was mimed, the king personifying Assur, the god who had replaced Marduk. The hero's gamos took place after the return from the banquet at the Bit Akitu. The last act consisted in the determination of the destinies for each month of the year. By determining it, the year was ritually created. That is, the good fortune, fertility, and richness of the new world that had just been born were insured. The role of the king in the Akitu is inadequately known. His humiliation corresponds to the regression of the world to chaos and to Marduk's captivity in the mountain. The king personifies the god in the battle against Tiamat and in the hero's gamos with a hieroduel. But identification with the god is not always indicated. As we have seen, during his humiliation, the king addresses Marduk. Nevertheless, the sacrality of the Mesopotamian sovereign is amply documented. Though the king recognized his earthly begetting, he was considered a son of God. This twofold descent made him supremely the intermediary between gods and men. The sovereign represented the people before the gods, and it was he who expiated the sins of his subjects. Sometimes he had to suffer death for his people's crimes. This is why the Assyrians had a substitute for the king. The texts proclaim that the king had lived in fellowship with the gods in the fabulous garden that contains the tree of life and the water of life. The king is the envoy of the gods, the shepherd of the people, named by God to establish justice and peace on earth. It could be said that the king shared in the divine modality, but without becoming a god. He represented the god, and this, on the archaic levels of culture, also implied that he was, in a way, he whom he personified. In any case, as mediator between the world of men and the world of the gods, the Mesopotamian king effected in his own person a ritual union between the two modalities of existence, the divine and the human. It was by virtue of this twofold nature that the king was considered, at least metaphorically, to be the creator of life and fertility. Marduk, in his manifestation as Namtilaku, was also the god who restores to life, who can restore all ruined gods as though they were his own creation, the lord who by holy incantation restores the dead gods to life. This idea echoes through ancient Egyptian theology, as described below. Marduk was Namshub as well, the bright god who brightens our way, which once again assimilates him to the sun, and Aseru, the god of resurrection, who causes the green herb to spring up. Whatever Marduk represents was also considered central to creation of rich abundance, to mercy and justice, to familial love, and, most interestingly, to the creation of ingenious things from the conflict with Tiamat. He was in fact addressed by 50 names by the Mesopotamians. Each name signified an independent, valuable attribute or property, likely at one time separate gods, now regarded as clearly dependent for its existence upon him. It seems evident that the attribution of these 50 names to Marduk parallels the movement toward monotheism described in the Enuma Elish itself, with all the gods organizing themselves voluntarily under Marduk's dominion, and occurring in Mesopotamian society at the human and historical level. It might be said that the Mesopotamians came to realize, in ritual and image at least, that all the life-sustaining processes that they worshipped in representation were secondary aspects of the exploratory, creative, rejuvenating process embodied by Marduk. A similar pattern of ritual and secondary conceptualization characterized ancient Egyptian society. In the earliest Egyptian cosmology, circa 2700 BC, the god Ptah, a spiritualized manifestation of Adam, the all-encircling serpent, creates by his mind, his heart, and his word, his tongue. Iliada states, Ptah is proclaimed the greatest god, Adam being considered only the author of the first divine couple. It is Ptah who made the gods exist. In short, the theogony and the cosmogony are effected by the creative power of the thought and word of a single god. We here certainly have the highest expression of Egyptian metaphysical speculation. As John Wilson observes, it is at the beginning of Egyptian history that we find a doctrine that can be compared with the Christian theology of the Logos, or Word. The Egyptians realized that consciousness and linguistic ability were vital to the existence of things, precisely as vital as the unknowable matrix of their being. This idea still has not fully permeated our explicit understanding, since we attribute the existence of things purely to their material substrate, despite its centrality to Christian thinking. The Egyptians viewed Ptah, the spermatic word, as the original or primordial, read heavenly, king. As in Mesopotamia, essentially, he ceded this power in the earthly domain to his successor, the pharaoh, his actual or literal son from the Egyptian viewpoint, as the pharaoh was viewed as God. The creative power thus transferred was literally defined by the Egyptians as the ability to put order Matt, in the place of chaos. Iliadic comments. It is these same terms that are used of Tutankhamun when he restored order after the heresy of Akhenaten or of Pepi II. He put Mat at the place of falsehood, of disorder. Similarly, the verb k, to shine, is used indifferently to depict the emergence of the sun at the moment of creation or at each dawn, and the appearance of the pharaoh at the coronation ceremony, at festivals, or at the privy council. The pharaoh is the incarnation of Mat, a term translated by truth, but whose general meaning is good order and hence right, justice. Mat belongs to the original creation, hence it reflects the perfection of the Golden Age. Since it constitutes the very foundation of the cosmos and life, Mat can be known by each individual separately. In texts of different origins and periods, there are such declarations as these. Incite your heart to know Mat. I make thee to know the thing of Mat in thy heart. Mayest thou do what is right for thee. Or, I was a man who loved Mat and hated sin. For I knew that sin is an abomination to God. And in fact, it is God who bestows the necessary knowledge. A prince is defined as one who knows truth, Mat, and whom God teaches. The author of a prayer to Re cries, Mayest thou give me Mat in my heart. As incarnating Mat, the pharaoh constitutes the paradigmatic example for all his subjects. As the vizier Rekh-mi-Re expresses it, he is a god who makes us live by his acts. The work of the pharaoh ensures the stability of the cosmos and the state, and hence the continuity of life. And, indeed, the cosmogony is repeated every morning when the solar god repels the serpent Apophis, though without being able to destroy him. For chaos equals the original darkness, represents virtuality. Hence it is indestructible. The pharaoh's political activity repeats Ray's exploit. He too repels Apophis. In other words, he sees to it that the world does not return to chaos. When enemies appear at the frontiers, they will be assimilated to Apophis, the god of primordial chaos, and the pharaoh's victory will reproduce Ray's triumph. The ideas of kingship, creativity, and renewal are given a different and more sophisticated slant in the central myth of Osiris, which served as an alternate basis for Egyptian theology. The story of Osiris and his son Horus is much more complex in some ways than the Mesopotamian creation myth or the story of Re, and describes the interactions between the constituent elements of experience in exceedingly compressed form. Osiris was a primeval king, a legendary ancestral figure who ruled Egypt wisely and fairly. His evil brother, Seth, whom he did not understand, rose up against him. Figure 23, the battle between Osiris and Seth in the domain of order, portrays this conflict as a war in the heavenly domain of order. Seth kills Osiris, that is, sends him to the underworld, and dismembers his body so that it can never be found. Figure 24, the involuntary descent and disintegration of Osiris, portrays Osiris in voluntary descent and disintegration and his quasi-existence in the underworld of chaos. The death of Osiris signifies two important things. One, the tendency of a static ruling idea, system of valuation, or particular story, no matter how initially magnificent or appropriate, to become increasingly irrelevant with time. And two, the dangers that necessarily accrue to a state that forgets or refuses to admit to the existence of the immortal deity of evil. Seth, the king's brother and opposite, represents the mythic hostile twin or adversary who eternally opposes the process of creative encounter with the unknown. signifies, alternatively speaking, a pattern of adaptation characterized by absolute opposition to establishment of divine order. When this principle gains control, that is, usurps the throne, the rightful king and his kingdom are necessarily doomed. Seth and figures like him, often represented in narrative by the corrupt right-hand man or advisor to the once great king, view human existence itself with contempt. Such figures are motivated only to protect or advance their position in the power hierarchy, even when the prevailing order is clearly counterproductive. Their actions necessarily speed the process of decay endemic to all structures. Osiris, although great, was naive in some profound sense, blind at least to the existence of immortal evil. This blindness and its resultant incaution brings about, or at least hastens, Osiris' demise. Osiris has a wife, as befits the king of order. Isis, as Osiris' mythic counterpart, is representative of the positive aspect of the unknown, like the hierodule in the Mesopotamian New Year's ritual. She is possessed of great magical powers, as might be expected, given her status. She gathers up Osiris' scattered pieces and makes herself pregnant with the use of his dismembered phallus. This story makes a profound point. The degeneration of the state or domain of order and its descent into chaos serves merely to fructify that domain and to make it pregnant. In chaos lurks great potential. When a great organization disintegrates, falls into pieces, the pieces might still usefully be fashioned into or give rise to something else, perhaps something more vital and still greater. Isis therefore gives birth to a son, Horus, who returns to his rightful kingdom to confront his evil uncle. This process is schematically represented in figure 25, the birth and return of Horus, divine son of order and chaos. Horus fights a difficult battle with Seth as the forces of evil are difficult to overcome and loses an eye in the process. Seth is overcome nonetheless. Horus recovers his eye. The story could stop there, narrative integrity intact, with the now whole and victorious Horus's well-deserved ascension to the throne. However, Horus does the unexpected, descending voluntarily to the underworld to find his father, as portrayed schematically in figure 26, voluntary encounter with the underworld. It is representation of this move, reminiscent of Marduk's voluntary journey to the underworld of Tiamat, that constitutes the brilliant and original contribution of Egyptian theology. Horus discovers Osiris, extant in a state of torpor. He offers his recovered eye to his father so that Osiris can see once again. They return united and victorious and establish a revivified kingdom. The kingdom of the son and father is an improvement over that of the father or the son alone, as it unites the hard-won wisdom of the past, that is, of the dead, with the adaptive capacity of the present, that is, of the living. The re-establishment and improvement of the domain of order is schematically represented in figure 27, ascent and reintegration of the father. In the story of Osiris, the senescence slash death of the father, presented as a consequence of the treachery of Seth, is overcome by the mythic son, the hero who temporarily defeats the power of evil and who rejuvenates the father. Marduk, the Mesopotamian supreme god, is by comparison a straightforward hero. He carves the familiar world from the unfamiliar. Horus, equally brave, is more complete and more sophisticated. He cannot remain content with his own ascension, feeling himself incomplete without his father. He therefore journeys voluntarily into the underworld, releases the disintegrated forces of tradition trapped there and makes them part of himself. This pattern of behavior constitutes an elaboration of that represented by Marduk, or of Re, the Egyptian sun god. Marduk creates order from chaos. That capacity, which is theoretically embodied in the form of the Mesopotamian emperor, lends temporal authority its rightful power. The same idea, elaborated substantially,